Hi, this is Daniel Jalkin.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition, You're Totally Gonna Pay For It. This week's episode is sponsored by Revenue Cat.
Hey, Daniel. Well, I'm back from a short vacation as we are leading up to Thanksgiving this week. Hope all our listeners, if you're doing Thanksgiving, hope you enjoy some time off. We've talked on the show before about how, like, we take time off, but we're also sort of always plugged in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went on a cruise, actually.
Ooh,
for
ooh la
a
la.
Few days. Yeah, it was nice to get away. But there's internet. You know, you can pay for internet.
Yeah. As I understand it, you can pay a pretty penny for some pretty mediocre internet.
So that is the case 5 years ago.
Oh, okay. Okay. Now it's good?
Now it's, I would say it is good.
Huh.
Not great, but I would not call it mediocre. So, long story short, they use Starlink now
on cruise ships. Oh, of course, right.
And it's respectable speed. Like, it's not fast. I mean, I have gigabit, you know, fiber at home. It's like, it's not that, obviously.
Right.
But it's acceptable, you know, do some email, you know, just tune into things, you know, whatever. I mean, it's not a big deal. I mean, you're not going to be like downloading, you know, huge files or...
Right.
Streaming, you know, HD movies.
You don't need to. You're on a cruise. You almost don't even need to work. You just plug in, check your email,
right.
Pick the most you know, emergency emails, and let everything else slide until you're back home in the comfort and safety of your own home.
That's how it should be, unless you're me and you have like an hour with your coffee in the morning and you'd feel like doing some work and deploying some changes to your server. And I did that and I made a mistake. There's something I didn't test. Like it was effectively a typo copy paste problem. And I was like, everything looks good. Things are working.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of signed off and, you know, a couple things broke for, I don't know, 10 hours, something like that. I don't know. And that was frustrating. That was a huge sort of amateur hour. Mistake.
Oh, well, so I mean, I only saw your post in the aftermath, so I must have missed the impact. But was it like, was micro.blog like totally down?
No, it wasn't totally down, but some posts were not routed correctly to the timeline and to like cross posted to other services. So it didn't affect like posting to your blog, you know, goes to your blog. And that actually is one nice thing about the way I built micro.blog is, even though it is this one kind of giant system, there are these separate pieces. And if something breaks, like in cross-posting, for example, that does not affect usually like posting to your blog. Or if micro.blog, the platform, is completely down, that also usually does not affect your own blog, like at your own domain name. Mm-hmm. That remains up. So that's a silver lining. But yeah, a couple of things did break. A lot of people noticed. It's, you know, it was frustrating. I shouldn't have let that slip through. So anytime something like that happens, I just have to be like extra careful afterwards.
It's always horrible when you break something and lots of people are affected by it. But the sort of flip side to that is lots of people noticing means lots of people are using your product, right?
So that's true.
And because I had a far, you know, I don't know, I guess I would say far less sort of like problematic issue in the latest update to Black Ink, that Black Ink for iOS in particular, that basically caused the app to crash whenever anybody tried to set up one of the authenticated, like login with a password block, or not blocks, crossword puzzles. And it's one of these things where it's like, I caught it relatively soon, but it's the kind of thing where if I had the number of users I wish I did, I would have caught it like the day it deployed, but I caught it like 2 weeks after it deployed.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine in a way, because like I said, well, I mean, it would be nice if I had caught it earlier, not only because it would have gotten fixed earlier, but because it would reflect a greater user base. Then again, the other flip side of that is because I don't have a huge user base, the reason nobody complained is nobody was affected by it, right?
Yeah, it's a trade-off. I always worry when there's little things like that. I mean, it wasn't so little. It might have really upset some people, so I shouldn't say it's little. that it just chips away at trust. And so, yeah, if you have one of those things happens once a year, not a big deal.
Yeah.
People are patient and forgiving. If it happens every month, then people start to think that the software is less reliable than it is reliable. Even if it's only like, 1% of the year, it feels like a much bigger impact than that. So that's not good.
I think that's true of a lot of things that either irritate us or literally, actually inconvenience us or actually do damage to us or our possessions. One time, and it you can kind of like, well, things happen, right? But every single time after that, at least within a certain window of time, it's like the effect is magnified. Like it might be like 10 times. Like, if you had that bug once on your cruise, and then when you got back a few days later, you did it again, you might hear from like 10 times as many people just because they're more angry about it. And then likewise, like the next day, if it happened yet again, then you'd have people like on Twitter, they wouldn't be on Twitter. They'd be on Micronaut. No. I think there's something to that where it's like, it's not that it's unfair. It's just that it's when you do things that are painful to other people, there's a lot of forgiveness and reasonableness about it at the beginning. And then it just gets like, I think maybe even like geometrically worse as you keep doing it. I mean, just go try to elbow somebody once and then do it again. By the third or fourth time, they're going to blow their top.
What's up? Yes. Yeah. No, that's a great point. It's not good. It's like you have to earn a good reputation. And I feel like I need to go many months now without any glitches. And there's always some little things, or like the server's slow one day and because traffic is up, and that kind of stuff does kind of ebb and flow, but no major problems. And it's just, I've been thinking sort of since that happened, like, why, how did I let that go through? And I think part of the problem, I mean, it's like kind of like a good thing and it's a bad thing also, is that I make changes to Micronaut Blog a lot. It's not like I work all the time for 2 months and then I've got all these changes and then I ship them. I'm making changes almost every day, maybe on average every 2 days, 3 days, I'll deploy a round of fixes or new features. And I'm just making changes all the time. And so I think that kind of increases the chance that something might be rushed out. Mm-hmm. Whereas, if I had a more formal process, maybe, a little more formal testing, maybe a little more automated testing.
Yep.
I would catch more things, but also the whole platform would move a lot more slowly.
Well, I know there's a lot of people out there who are, speaking of testing, they're unit testing aficionados who are screaming right now, like, do you have unit tests?
Yeah.
So why don't we answer that for them?
Pretty much no. I don't. I have some ways to test things. I've just never bought into it. Mm-hmm. And this case, the thing that broke, is actually a really good example of something that could have been caught by unit test fairly easily. So if I had run that as an extra check before deploying, I probably would have caught it. But also, it's so complicated. Like, the bug was in the handling of feeds, which, if you don't know how Micronaut Blog works, it's not like most networks where you post and then you've posted. It's like you post, it goes into like a system using Hugo, which renders your site. It uploads HTML pages. There's other things in the middle that bridge things together. It posts to your blog. Then it downloads the feed from your blog and it processes that. It adds the timeline. It adds to Blue Sky. It's kind of a complicated kind of mesh of systems. And so it was in that, like, I'm reading a feed and I'm processing things and I could route it different ways. So in theory, yes, I could have tests that completely end-to-end test that system. And I should. Mm-hmm. But I don't. I don't have it. It's a good candidate for automated testing, but it would require lots and lots of tests to make sure that everything was covered.
Well, you can't. This is great opening because, again, the unit test aficionados are screaming right now. Like, you don't need lots of tests. You only need one test, right? One test is a start. And I think they would probably, and I guess it's not just them. I am encouraging you, Manton. And I don't take my own medicine on this fully. I'm kind of like a half dedicated unit tester. But you can start with just the one that covers the latest thing that went wrong. And it's okay for you to have a unit test suite of one test.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think you would go a long way, actually, just to set up something that is automated that runs either periodically or preferably, I think, as a result of commits to your source base.
Mm-hmm.
That's the setup I have right now. And we've talked about this before. I have a build server for all my Mac products. You don't need a build server. In this case, you can just use a server, right? I think it would be what I envision as being useful is just to have like almost like your test suite can be like oriented around a sort of virtual user who just like has activities they do, like posting to micro.blog and expecting it to show up on Blue Sky. And, you know, again, ideally in the unit testing world, you don't actually do the thing. You just like simulate it. But I think there's something to listen. You're describing such a complex system. It's the complexity of systems. It's the complexity of my apps is what has motivated me to the extent that I do unit testing over the years, because it does give you that sense of like, I don't have every edge case covered, but every so often, I wouldn't even say every so often, quite often when I commit things, my build breaks, you know, and it breaks because my unit tests fail often. And it's like, oh, this just happened the other day. It was like, wow, well, I'm glad I didn't ship that because, you know, that would have meant like, I forget what it was, but it was something like, you know, images were not being saved properly with the blog post or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so one of the disciplines I know a lot of testing people talk about is to, at a minimum, write a unit test for every bug you fix. You know, there's test-driven development, which is the sort of classic, the idea that you're so all in on testing that you write a test for the anticipated behavior before you ever implement anything. Right. And I can't get in. I mean, I do that. I've done that sometimes, especially as a tool for tackling a really hairy, complex problem, because I can kind of chip away. But honestly, covering the bugs you've already discovered and fixed. Well, we talked about like how bad it would be if you had another mess up. The other mess up is worse if it's the exact same thing.
Right. Well, and also to the user, sometimes there's like two completely different bugs, but they look like they might be the same thing. And so to the user, like, you're having the same problem again. Of course, it's completely different, but like, they don't know. They can't trace through the code. I definitely can't get behind. I mean, I can barely get behind testing also. I definitely can't get behind like test-driven development to the extent of writing the test first, because sometimes you don't know exactly what final form the feature will take, like where the code is going to be, how it's going to be architected, even what the feature looks like. Sometimes like you have to build the thing before you understand it. And so if you write your test first, half the tests are going to be wrong. So I can't really get behind that for my projects. Maybe it works great for some people. But what you said with the virtual user, I think resonates with me a lot, because there are pieces of this that kind of have to be tested live. Like, yeah, technically I could mock some network stuff where it's like fakes connecting to Blue Sky, for example, and that would catch some things. But I mean, I don't think there's really a perfect substitute for actually going through the process that a user would go through. And so like if I had like a kind of virtual user that's not my normal like Manton account, even if it was in I wouldn't say production, although that would be interesting, but it, just as a separate user that could go through this flow and had its own Blue Sky account, Mastodon account, Flickr account, whatever, like that would be interesting. And that could, that would solve problems from a certain angle.
Yeah. I mean, I think honestly, it never feels like a good use of time to go work on testing infrastructure, but it is kind of like a, bit by bit, it becomes a substantial resource.
Yeah.
You know, now at this point today, when I make a mistake in my code, there's ripple effects too often. And so it's like, maybe I didn't quite test one subsystem well enough, but just so happens the way I test this other system also breaks if something, you know, else gets screwed up. So I kind of have like, you know, the more stuff that can break, the better when you have a unit testing like set up. I try to do this. I don't, like I said, I'm not perfect, especially because even after all these years of unit testing, moderately, I often feel at a bit of a loss of how to unit test something. And so if I run up against like a, you know, wall of like, I don't know how to handle this, then I'll often just say, well, moving on. But sometimes I know the unit test could be written and I know it will guarantee that I don't commit code that does the exact same thing again.
Yeah.
And so I write the test, or if it's like an emergency, like getting something out, I will fix the bug and ship it after writing myself a quick ticket/bug report that is just to write the unit test that covers that case.
That's a good practice. Yeah. Can't really argue with that too much. There's kind of the things we know to do and the things that we should be doing and don't actually get around to it. But no, that's a good practice. And there's other downsides to unit testing. I think we don't need to get into it, but I mean, it does create some overhead, some complexity, changes how you maybe refactor things. I mean, that's all sort of nitpicking though. I think there is a core part of being sort of just kind of principled and sticking to some testing that would benefit me. And I'm sure I said that like 10 years ago, and I'm saying that again now.
Right. So don't count on it, right? Yeah. Well, you know, I think that, again, just to emphasize to you and to everybody else listening who maybe doesn't do any tests, it really isn't an all or nothing game. Anything helps, you know, it's like one little thing might save your butt one day. Start with one test and see how it goes. All right, we're sponsored this week by Revenue Cat. Revenue Cat's open source framework provides a wrapper around StoreKit and a backend to make implementing and managing in-app purchases easy. Using Revenue Cat solves for edge cases you don't even know you have, protects you from outages your team hasn't even seen yet, and structures your data in a way that makes analyzing and integrating IAP data simple. Plus, you get out-of-the-box charts, a remote paywall builder, experiments to A/B test your pricing and offers, and more. What's best of all of this is completely free until you hit $2,500 a month in revenue on the app stores. And all of the plans are free until you ship. So try it out for yourself at revenuecat.com and save countless hours a year dealing with IAP code.
All right, Daniel. Well, we'd like to pull some tips and different things from Revenue Cat's blog. And their latest, not actually a tip, but a way to get a whole bunch of tips, which is the RC Growth Challenge. Essentially, you post with the RC Growth Challenge hashtag, and they pick a winner to get $15,000 budget and 3 months of hands-on support from Stephen P. Young, the founder of App Masters. That's usually $22,000 worth a bunch of money for that kind of hands-on support about like, your app, what you're doing right, what you're doing wrong, different best practices, growth hacks to figure things out. There's a whole list of things that they will help you with if you win. So check that out if you're interested in that contest. Revenue Cat, with or without the contest, great way to get started with in-app purchase and subscriptions. Go to revenuecat.com.
All
So Daniel, speaking of posting to Blue Sky, I mentioned that a couple of times, and I wrote a blog post today about Blue Sky and Mastodon. Just it was kind of in response to a lot of people, especially in the Mastodon community, saying, you know, Mastodon's good, decentralized, Blue Sky's bad, centralized. And I don't think it's quite that simple. Mm-hmm. I think it's more complicated than that because they're very different architectures. So I wanted to address that a little bit and sort of end on a hopeful note that the web's in a pretty good place. So we've got a lot going on right now that's very exciting. And one of the things that I think is blowing people's mind a little bit is that Blue Sky crossed 20 million users. Now I think it's up to like 22 plus. And for a while last week, they were gaining about 1 million users a day.
A day. Wow.
And they're still not up to, you know, like Meta level.
Yep.
But also they're not like whatever multi-billion dollar thousands of people company. They're 20 people. And I think they've pulled off something really, really impressive.
Yeah.
And yeah, we'll see where it goes. But just the fact that Blue Sky, like a year ago, they were very criticized for not adopting ActivityPub and being compatible with Mastodon. And now they're over twice as big as Mastodon. So something interesting is happening.
Yeah, I really think I was actually listening to Dithering, our friend's podcast, John Gruber and Ben Thompson.
Yeah.
And they were talking about Blue Sky, and John sort of harkened back to a post he had made a year or so ago saying he predicted Blue Sky would ultimately come out on top because it's the most like Twitter.
Yeah, no question.
And I thought Ben had a good point, which is, well, you know, is that really an advantage? Being the most like something in a way is also saying you're the least differentiated. But it's these situations where people are making an active choice to leave X, that they're looking for something new. And in that scenario, having it be as similar as possible is good. And yeah. I think, you know, you sort of surprised me a couple weeks ago when you told me about Blue Sky's membership, user count. And it was a lot higher than I thought. And then, like, even before the election, something was happening with Blue Sky. I don't know. It was creeping up. And
there was a few different big waves, including Brazil losing access to Twitter for a couple weeks. And that was a huge influx of users. And there was a couple other things. But
yeah. Well, so now I think I remember when you told me about that. It was just a couple weeks ago, 3 weeks, let's say. And I'm looking now, and this is just one metric, but the number of followers I have on Blue Sky has tripled in that time.
Wow.
And it's hard to keep up with because I am seeing a lot of follows come in, and it's like, well, I want to follow back the people I know, but it's like, God, it's a lot to keep up with, like, you know? And and this is not ever a problem I had on Blue Sky before the past 3 weeks. So something real is happening. I think another thing they brought up on Dithering was, you know, Blue Sky has, for whatever reason, has really cashed in, so to speak, on celebrity use, right? Like I think, again, maybe that's partly because it's another area where they benefit from being so similar to Twitter, is it's like, celebrities don't care about Mastodon. I mean, they're not like, well, ActivityPub is important to the internet. You know, they don't care about that. Maybe, you know, one or two maybe do, the weird web nerd celebrities. But, you know, Taylor Swift or whatever is not like, they just want to get their connected to their fans, you know? And
yeah.
But celebrities lead crowds, you know? That's the bottom line. And
especially when you have, if you have a celebrity that is frustrated with Twitter and publicly says, I'm done here, follow me on Blue Sky.
Yep. They model the behavior of leaving Twitter. And, you know, a lot of people who admire celebrities, they dream about being like them. They want to sing like them or play like them or, you know, think like them. And then when somebody like that models a behavior online that you can literally do yourself, it's like, well, here's my big chance. I never could sing like Taylor Swift, but I can quit Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, so-and-so. I don't even know if she's quit Twitter, but
I don't either, but there definitely been some people that are very high profile have. And also if the fans want to hear from their celebrity.
Yeah.
So they just got the message. They're not going to hear from them on Twitter anymore. So let's go see where they're going to hear from. Yeah. No, it's a big deal. I haven't listened to The Dithering lately. To be honest, I've kind of stopped listening to podcasts the last 2 weeks. It's kind of sad, but I just don't listen to podcasts. I just like stop cold turkey. I will pick them up again at some point. But I could not listen to any podcasts after the election. I'll just leave it at that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I like that point that you said Ben made about, well, sometimes it's better to be different. Speaking from micro.blog, I think a lot of people, when I announced micro.blog, expected it to be more of a Twitter clone than it is. And so they were confused and disappointed, and they sort of didn't use it. And on one hand, well, that's a bummer, because I would like to have more people using it. But on the other hand, I do like leaning into the ways that it's different. And I've kind of accepted this idea that it will be different in important ways, and it will be smaller. And as long as it can keep growing and have a good customer base, that's fine. Like, I don't really want to be in Blue Sky's shoes with the large team and the million users coming in every day. That is a different scale. I don't want to deal with that, honestly.
Right. You've never wanted that. I mean, it's all the way from the beginning. And that is good. When you have a differentiation that not only makes you happy, but by definition, warns off potential competitors, because most people are looking for the next big thing.
Right.
You know, and when you decide that the thing you want to do is just to have a really nice smaller thing, you automatically have a better chance of succeeding at that, because there's very few other people who are like, you know what, I want to have the best microblogging service. the best microblogging service that, you know, doesn't have more than, let's say, a million users.
Right. Yeah. It's there's probably other people, but it actually shocks me sometimes that no one has tried to do what I've been doing for 7 years. No one's put the pieces together in the same way. Fine, I'll run with it. But it's actually nice to, I'm glad that there are other big social platforms, or even small social platforms, doing things in a different way, I guess. Like I get requests sometimes for a certain feature. And I actually had included this in the blog post I posted today, where someone wants a certain feature. I don't think it fits with micro.blog. I don't think it works with what I've tried to create. And the fact that, like, Blue Sky, for example, is doing that thing is freeing to me, because, hey, if you want the thing, that look, just Blue Sky's right there, and we integrate with Blue Sky. And now I'm not going to tell people, stop asking me for the thing, but internally I can think, I no longer have to be guilty that I'm not doing that thing, because there are other things out there. Right. And actually, I've been thinking about this with pricing, too. There are a lot of free, you know, platforms out there.
Yep.
I am not going to be free. In fact, I am going to be less free over time, because there are a lot of choices to be free. There aren't a lot of choices for $5 a month that give you a blog, domain name, cross-posting, a bunch of features, apps. There aren't those things. And that's what I am.
That's it. And this is, I mean, 37 Signals has obviously changed a lot over the years, but in one way they haven't changed is kind of continuing to be the model for you of, like, a small, profitable, money, you know, bootstrap based. They also exemplify the, we don't need to be, you know, for just for one example, we don't need to be Gmail, but we want to be like a nice email app.
Yeah, totally.
But you're totally going to pay for it. There's no free tier.
Yeah, making like a small version of Gmail that's free is not a business. Yeah, like it's just, it just isn't. And yeah, because it would attract the same people that are just using Gmail and aren't going to switch. Yeah, well, it's good. So, I mean, I don't know. Congrats to the Blue Sky people. I'm fascinated with the growth and the different approaches. And I don't think, I mean, Mastodon is here for the long haul too. Like, they're not going anywhere. There's a lot of good work going on behind the scenes in standards groups. I've kind of poked my head into some of those meetings, like in the W3C social community working group, not working group, the community group for a lot of people talking about ActivityPub. And like, there's a lot of good work going on behind the scenes. And yeah, it's a good time to build for the web. I'm excited. There's so many different things that can be built right now.
I mean, it's amazing. The way that technology right now is so powerful, so cheap, so separately from power, from sheer power, so useful. You know, there's so just the fact that you can rent a server on somebody else's server farm and run any of like 1,000 high class, like industry tested open source projects. I mean, it kind of baffles the mind to think how fortunate people are today if they want to go out and make things. You know, when we were younger, Manson and I, starting like with Mac software, let's say, you had to do a lot yourself, you know? And it's just amazing. It makes me wonder where we're going next, because, you know, something's going to happen over the next 10 years where people are going to look back at what we have now and think, man, remember when we had to rent a server, you know, or whatever? Right. It's going to be like, I don't know what it's going to be, but.
Yeah. Remember when we didn't have an AI agent that would just set up our servers for us before we even knew what we needed?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're in an optimistic, good mood. That's a good way to be right now, especially right before Thanksgiving. Sounds like you are thankful for the state of the web as it is today. And what a great position to be in if you're developing something for the web. I hope.
I can't complain. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening to the show. Thanks to our sponsor, Revenue Cat. Talk to you next time.
All right. See you then.